ICRA defines Class 3 gaming to include common casino games such as roulette, craps, chemin de fer, baccarat, and banking card games like blackjack, and also all mechanical or electronic gambling machines such as slot machines and video poker devices. Under IGRA, a state that permits a particular type of gaming for any purpose by any person cannot prohibit that type of gaming by a tribe located in the state. A tribe that wants to engage in Class 3 gaming must give notice to the state that it wishes to negotiate a compact. And upon receiving that notice, the state must negotiate with the tribe in good faith. If the state and the tribe do not reach agreement, they will be required by federal law to go through a mediation process. And if that does not result in an agreement, the U.S. Secretary of Interior, who has responsibility for administering IGRA, will set the terms of the compact. Even when a compact has been successfully negotiated, it will not go into effect until the Secretary of Interior has published a notice of approval of the compact in the Federal Register. In Minnesota, the negotiation of compacts is regulated by Minnesota Statute Section 3.9221, which was originally enacted in 1989. This section delegates authority to negotiate compacts, specifies provisions that may and must be included in compacts, requires the state to respond to requests for compact negotiation within a specified period of time, and requires annual reports about the status of compact negotiation. I'll briefly discuss each of these statutory requirements. Section 3.9221 requires the governor or the governor's designated representatives to negotiate a Class 3 gambling compact when a tribe requests negotiation under IGRA. The law specifies the state attorney general will serve as legal counsel to the governor or the governor's representatives with regard to the negotiation of a compact. If the governor chooses to appoint representatives to negotiate, the representatives must include at least 2 members of the Senate and 2 members of the House of Representatives, and 2 of these members must be the chairs of the standing committees with jurisdiction over gambling policy. Section 3.9221 states that a gaming compact may include any provision that's authorized under IGRA, which effectively permits provisions about any subject directly related to the operation of Class 3 gaming activities. For example, Minnesota's current tribal state compacts address issues such as the allocation of criminal and civil jurisdiction between the state and the tribe, assessments of the tribes to defray the state's cost of regulating Class 3 gambling, and standards for the operation of Class 3 games. In addition to stating that a Class 3 gaming compact may include any provision authorized by IGRA, Minnesota law also provides that any compact that the state enters must contain 2 specific provisions. The first is a provision recognizing the right of each party to the agreement, including the legislature by joint resolution, to request that the agreement be renegotiated or replaced by a new compact. The compact must provide the terms under which either party can request renegotiation. Second, the compact must include a provision stating that if either party does request renegotiation or a new compact, the existing compact will remain in effect until the renegotiation or replacement of the compact is complete. Section 3.9221 only gives the governor or his representatives authority to negotiate a compact for a period of 180 days following after receiving a request for negotiation. This is consistent with the provision of IGRA that allows a tribe to bring a federal action against a state if the state fails to negotiate within 180 days of receiving a request for negotiation. Finally, Section 3.9221 requires the governor, the governor's representatives, and the attorney general to annually report to the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over gambling regulation. This report must include information about compacts that have been negotiated and outline prospective compact negotiations. Nothing prevents the Minnesota legislature from amending Section 3.9221 to modify the procedures for future compact negotiations in Minnesota. For example, the legislature could require legislative ratification of compacts or require that any compact entered by the state have a fixed duration. However, even if the legislature were to amend Section 3.9221, it could not require the renegotiation of existing compacts. Although the terms of the compacts allow either party to request renegotiation, neither party can require it. The compacts do not have an expiration date. Thus, any legislative changes to the regulation of compact negotiation in Minnesota would apply prospectively and would not have any bearing on the compacts that Minnesota has already negotiated. And that's the extent of my comments, Mr. Westerberg.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We really appreciate the help. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest here today. Her name is Lana Olin, and she served 16 years in the Kansas Senate. She has served as the Majority Leader from 2000 to 2004. She has also served as Chair of the National Conference of State Legislators, Standing Committees, Chair of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact, Chair of the Audit Committee for the National Board of Professional Teaching Standards, and Senator Olin is a teacher by profession and is a Kansas master teacher. Our presentation today by Lana Olin, also, I guess I should mention that she's been a member of the Advisory Council on the Publication of Government to Government, Understanding State and Tribal Governments, working with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And this project in particular was to promote intergovernmental cooperation between states and tribes by researching, assessing, disseminating information about how devolution will affect Indian tribes and the state-tribal relationship. And with that, I would like to turn the mic over to Senator Olin and ask you to proceed with your presentation. Welcome to Minnesota.
Thank you, Chairman Westerberg and members of the committee. I am pleased to have some time to spend with you today reflecting on some on Indian law, some on federal law, and the issue at hand, which your legislature may be wrestling this session, dealing with additional compacts. Mr. Chairman, if I could ask one question of the researcher?
Counsel?
Okay. Yes. When you were talking about the negotiation process and the governor to appoint legislators for the to negotiate compacts, has that actually occurred?
I believe that. Mr. Chair, Ms. Olin, I believe that occurred with the original negotiation of the compacts in the early 90s, and that the governor did appoint a team in accord with the statute.
Okay. Okay. Thanks. That kind of gives me some background before I do background, so I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, you did mention a few of the areas in which I have had some experience, and I'm not going to belabor my background, but I always like to know where someone is coming from in regard to issues. And I did chair what we have in Kansas called the Federal and State Affairs Committee. I did that for 8 years, and we had a whole host of issues in that committee: capital punishment, referendum and initiative, term limits, alcohol, abortion, guns, and gambling. It was an interesting committee, and just wanting to let you know that while we gave forum to all of those issues, we didn't necessarily put a great number of bills on those. But from that, that's when I first started learning about some of the gaming that was going to be happening in our state. When I was elected in '88, of course, we had EGRA and working toward that, and looking at what the city's responses were and wanting to know about revenue sharing, state government, and, of course, the changes that have occurred and interpretations through court law since then. So I didn't plan on majoring on gambling, but when you chair a committee for 8 years, and that is one of the hot topics that comes every year during the session, that did give me an experience to learn more about it through some other associations. 6 years ago, our Republican governor, Bill Graves, was involved with the Department of Revenue in a number of lawsuits with Indian tribes and Indian nations in Kansas. And some of us got together to talk about how we might be able to better address and better communicate. And that is when we came up with the Joint Committee on State-Tribal Relations. The hybrid committee, as your legislature, is mostly composed of House members for a House committee and Senate members for a Senate committee. You might have some joint committees that meet during the interim or standing joint committees. But and we have those too. But we made this committee just a little bit different, in that most of the areas in which we seem to be having some dissension were in taxation issues and, of course, with lawsuits, the judicial arena. So we made certain that the members of the committee, there was an equal number of House and Senate members on the committee, represented the Federal and State Affairs Committee that dealt primarily with tribal issues, the Taxation Committee, the Judiciary Committee, and then we had the Attorney General on the committee, again, a little bit different in the approach, and the governor had an appointee. And we meet regularly. I have served as elected chair three years on that and 3 years as the vice chair since its inception. And we were able to, during our time, we made the decision that the chairs of all the resident tribes in Kansas would also be at the table. We have had hearings and discussion and legislation on a host of issues in Kansas, and I think it has really served us well, having that particular hybrid committee. Of course, as majority leader, one sets the calendar and decides what will run in respective chamber and what will not. And from that, I've had the experience not only of working with tribal representatives and elected officials, but also the various components of all of the other gaming industry. I know that you have horse racing here. We have horse racing, and we have dog racing, the paramutual industry, in addition to the tribal and to the lottery and keno and that kind of thing. So kind of seeing what those priorities are and seeing what business the state needs to get done before another, I think, has been an important growing experience for me. All of us are eligible to belong to the National Conference of Legislators from Gaming States. And many of you may be members of ALEC. I served as their state chair, served as standing committee chair for the National Conference of State Legislatures, and helped to co-found this National Conference of Legislators from Gaming States. It majors in gaming or gambling, whichever you want to call it. People call it different things. The purest definition I've heard is gambling is the actual act of placing bets. And when you use the word gaming, it means all of the accoutrements that go along with it. So when I use those, I refer to it interchangeably, but wanted you to be aware that this particular conference, that's all that it's about. That's all that those legislators deal with. Some are very opposed to gaming in any form. Others, you know, promote it, have areas that they represent within their own state constituencies. But the goal of NICLGs, as we use the acronym, is to make certain that we have regulation and oversight and that things are run in a proper manner. So that's the commonality of that group. And in working with that, one of our standing committees is pertains to tribal gaming, and I've had some experience in working with that. 5 years ago, the Kellogg Foundation, who has had an interest in government access for people of all stripes and of all leanings, indicated they wanted to work on a cooperative project. They, too, saw that devolution, where the federal government has returned some of the responsibilities, sometimes with and sometimes without the necessary funds to go with it. But we were experiencing that, and so were tribal communities. So they worked with the National Congress of American Indians. And again, each one of you is a member of NCFL. Well, the National Conference of American Indians is like a Congress as well. It's their membership organization group. And about two-thirds to three-fourths of the tribes and Indian nations in, within the U.S. boundaries actually belong to this group, and they have offices in Washington and so on, Washington, D.C. We work with them in cooperation of a couple of pieces of information. One of those I am going to highlight, just a few parts of that, the green book of the two that will be, I don't know if they are distributed now, Mr. Chairman, or but I'll be going back to those in just a little bit. And I'll pause here just a minute to thank Brian Fahey for picking me up at the airport and kind of serving as the person who's led me along so far, and also to report to you, Brian, that I believe I left my green book in your office. So when we get to that, I don't have to have my own book, but I'll have to have a copy of one to be able to highlight a few things for you. But thank you again. You've been most hospitable. So working with that, we found those commonalities where states and tribal leaders could work together. And then as chair of the National Conference of Standing state legislature standing committee was appointed last year by the elected president of NCSL, Marty Stevens, who's Speaker of the House in Utah, to head up the chairing of the 11 committees for NCSL. And from that, and on behalf of Speaker Stevens, I was able to work with the Smithsonian in the opening of that particular wonderful new museum, and have been a spokesperson on several issues and represented NCSL with several groups pertaining to Indian law and Indian governing. You know, gambling is a it's a fast pace and a fast changing activity, and I mean that literally and figuratively. And I think many times we look to wanting to discuss what we have as a state, what the revenue piece components are, and where states may or may decide our policy position if they want to move. Much of that exposure has been within the last 15 years since the passage of EGRM. And I am not going to belabor you with the history lesson. I know you might get a little nervous when you look at that next entry on this working paragraph of 1781, but I'm not going to spend a great deal of time. I'm going to just hit the high points on a few key components here. As your chair pointed out, I'm a teacher by profession, so you have before you a working outline, and as I move through this, it gives you an idea. You can kind of look ahead and see if I'm going to cover something that you might want to ask about, but if as I get to an area and you think your question is relevant and want to ask it at any time, I don't mind. I don't consider it an interruption. I consider it a clarification. So I hope that you will do that and work for your chair in recognizing.
I would concur with that.
Okay. Is there anybody who has any questions thus far? Okay. A little bit on the history. On the Articles of Confederation, that was the first official mention of acknowledgement of tribal Indian affairs, and the federal government gave itself the sole and exclusive responsibility over the Indian affairs. That was, of course, reconfirmed and reworded, but still the same direction in the U.S. Constitution in 1787. And things moved along quite swimmingly, and, you know, people were settling parts of this country. The Marshall Trilogy by Chief Justice John Marshall, and again, all of those cases are certainly available for your purview, but I am going to only hit on a couple of high points on that. Those three in total over a number of years reaffirmed the political and legal standing. And in these three decisions, they reaffirmed the sovereignty of the Indian tribes, and they reaffirmed that it predated any European arrival of any of us. However, because the Indian nations were within the U.S. boundaries, they are considered, and I quote, domestic dependent nations, and only Congress has the right to limit their powers, but they recognize them as sovereign nations. Individual states, that's reflective of ourselves here in state government, are limited by the state tribal compacts. And I've had an opportunity to learn that in your state you have a number of compacts in place, particularly tax compacts. That's good. There are so many states that are not in a form of communication to be able to make those kinds of wise decisions, and instead spend lots and lots of taxpayer dollars litigating in the court. So I was pleased to learn of yours, and in that second booklet of the two, the one that's blue, those are some of the things that have actually worked in states with state government and tribal governments working together, and you have some mentioned there in that book. So, looking to the Dawes General Allotment Act, and that was in 1887, that was one of those times when federal government felt that it would be better to integrate and tribal members into the American settlement way. What they did, even though we had, by treaty, had reservations, they did what they called an allotment process. And sometimes you'll hear this referenced as the checkerboard effect. You'll have a large reservation that has been defined by treaty, but then it's through the Dawes Act, again, federal government, you know, had the ability here, and they had the votes. So they went in and they kind of chunked it up, and then they checkerboarded so that this would be tribal owner, non-tribal, tribal owner, non-tribal, and thinking that that would help to kind of, through osmosis, I guess, make everyone like one another and get along and everybody be the same type of people. It didn't work, but during that time, it was about ninety million acres of land that had been in reservations went off of the reservation status. So many times when you hear, and I was talking with one of your representatives on the committee about trust land and fee land and why these things happen and why tribes want to buy land or nations want to buy land, they want to buy back the checkerboard thing because it was reversed by the federal law in the Wheeler Act of 1934. And that was the Indian Reorganization Act, and they said, whoops, we didn't do this right. We need to reorder, and because we screwed up, well, I don't want to paraphrase because I wasn't there, but because things didn't work the way we planned, we are going to assume more of a trust responsibility for tribes. And that's when land is now purchased back, there is no money that goes to the state. It is a trust responsibility of the federal government. They kind of came back on to what their practice had been during the more of the colonial time. Some significant legislation happened during the Nixon and Ford administrations, and that was the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act of 75. And it started out as a health care determination. Before that, the federal government had provided all health care, and they were in charge. And devolution was just kind of started to be thought about then. And the tribal self-governance came into effect, where basically Nixon said they have the ability to elect tribal leaders and got to, you know, be recognizing that, and they ought to be determining some of their own economic opportunities. So when that was settled, that's when a number of tribes, I'm not speaking for all of them, and I realize that there are tribal members here, and none of them are frowning yet, so I think I'm still okay. But that is when many became more empowered during that time in taking charge of where they thought their economic opportunities might be. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is the last one I have mentioned there, and as many of us are aware, during the time of the economic hardships of many of the tribes and prior to gaming, they were looking at economic opportunities. And one of the opportunities that presented itself that was discussed in Washington was for tribal lands to be used for nuclear waste sites. And that made, quite frankly, a lot of congressmen and congresswomen kind of nervous that that would be something that might be able to happen. So they further explored other opportunities, and Congress agreed to the expansion of casino gaming or Class 3 gaming for those states that had it. Then they were going to be able for tribal members to have that as well. And that's where many of us, I think, kind of came in, either to the legislature or into the knowledge base as things have moved forward from there. Also during that time, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was downsized. The federal budget was cut. We're giving you this opportunity to work on economic development initiatives. We're going to do away with some of the dollars. And that's where now we have about one in three tribes in the United States involved in gaming. And some make many dollars and some struggle. In my state, for instance, the four resident tribes that we have are all in more of a rural area. One of the reservation casino sites now is about 30 miles north of Topeka. We consider Topeka a fairly good sized town. I know it doesn't measure up to the Twin Cities status, but the others are on very rural environments, and they're all kind of clustered in one place. In looking at the proposals that you specifically may be considering this year, it's my understanding that you have one that might be similar to something that Kansas has looked at as well. Of course, Kansas City, some people think that's in Kansas, and some people think that's in Missouri, and they're all right, because it is a shared city. We don't go so far as to call it a twin city. It's like a clone city, but it's on two sides. And on the Missouri side in Kansas, we have significant river boats. The notion was they were going to be like Mark Twain, you know, Hannibal, Missouri, and, you know, but they aren't. They are in moats, and they don't have engines, and they actually diffuse some of the water off. I can say this because I'm not. Actually, I can say it because I was born in Missouri, but I play that down when I'm running, you know, for election in Kansas. But what you find is that as that occurs, much of the population base, you know, when people go to gamble, they were leaving our state. So we have had over. Since the implementation of the compact, a constant number of interested individuals to expand gambling in a variety of ways in Kansas. Our generation of lottery, and I think yours too, maybe has moved a bit. In Kansas, when people voted for the lottery, I am convinced the majority thought it was a scratch ticket and that would be the end of it, and we know that it is much more sophisticated, much more competitive now. You can quickly, and there are a couple people in here, I think, that know my record on gambling. That record is behind me, but I'm very cautious on expanding gambling opportunities, and I know that part of that is because of the strong regulation oversight that I think is so important. When we look at negotiating compacts on newly acquired land or land that has not been part of a reservation, and it is a different ballgame. It is new turf. It's been done in a very limited number of ways, and that's what I wanted to spend a little time with you on right now. In listening to the researcher, and I'm sorry, your name is?
Miss Long.
Miss Long, okay. When I was listening to Miss Long, she indicated about you have class three, you have to negotiate in good faith and so on. Yes, all of that is true. Unless you are looking for placing a casino or a gambling facility off of reservation. You don't have to do it at all. It's not a requirement, but it is a possibility. And when you have that possibility, and you couple that with the fact that it's been a number of years since you've created a compact, it has in Kansas too. And so there's certain components that I think one wants to be aware of. In looking to a couple of pieces of information that I brought with me, one of those, which we'll discuss in a little bit, deals with the Kansas approach that is still pending before the legislature. Another piece of information that I brought is from that Nickel Cheese group that I was telling you about that legislators belong to. They have what is referred to as a legislative checklist, things that you should look for, components that ought to be in a compact. And the chair and I took a look at that together for a few minutes before this meeting started, and it's got a couple, about 30, 35, 40 pages. So I didn't want to really bring it, but I'll be leaving that for you to reference. And you also can get that with ready access through nclgs.org on the website. You could look up the proposed compact checklist. I think right now I'd like to just take a few moments, and before we talk about specifics on either compacts or looking at what your state maybe is considering, if it's acceptable with the chair, I'd like to go ahead and show this video.
That sounds really good. Are there any questions from any members up to this point?
It's about a 10 to 12 minute video, and it is better than bipartisan. It is nonpartisan.
Okay.
It's from the National Issues Forum.
Okay, if we could just hold you for 1 second. We do have one question here. Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forget your last name.
Lane.
Lane.
Uh-huh.
Olin. Okay. Maybe I missed it right in the beginning when I wasn't here, but how many casinos are... how many reservations do you have in Kansas? You said there was four casinos. Is that...
Yes, we have four resident tribes, and we have four compacts. Basically, they are all very similar. They were passed within a six-month period of one another and have been in place since 1991.
Okay. And do you have renewal dates on yours?
No.
No.
That's part of what I would refer to as first-generation compacts. A lot of us have those in our state. We did not have renewal. A compact, of course, is between two self-standing entities rather than a contract. And what you find in that, I would say the majority of states that compacted before 94, they do not have renewal dates on them. The new one that Kansas is considering does, but it was mutually agreed to by both the two tribes that are compacting as well as the governor representing the state at this point. And it also is really different as to how states handle that. I mean, it was good to hear the remarks before mine to see how your state maybe can have the governor designate some folks, and it's a bipartisan approach. In Kansas, it's the governor, but the legislature has to approve the compact. And it's all over the map as to how it's done, but we share that status as first generation. And when I use that term, I mean contracts and compacts that are in perpetuity. Another example, and maybe I should move to that since you've...
Well, and that we can get covered after the video too. I don't want to rush you
right
through it, so that's fine.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Anderson.
Senator, do you have to have Indian ground in order to have a casino in Kansas?
Senator Orlean?
Yes. With EGRA, it must be a federally recognized tribe, and the land for it to be based on required negotiation is October 17, 1988. So if a tribe is federally recognized and had the land in trust, they could move forward in negotiating a gaming compact.
Representative Anderson.
The land must be in trust?
If the land is in trust, that is what triggers the ability for the state to begin, or for the tribes to begin negotiating. Of course, you have to have the presence of Class 3 gaming, too.
Senator, are you aware of any casinos that are, Indian gaming casinos that are not on Indian reservation land?
I understand that there are two, and I literally had a call back to my state to research to try to find that before we came in here. It dawned on me after I saw you that maybe I should find out. But I understand that there are two that Secretary Norton has approved. Another hybrid to that would be the work that Governor Schwarzenegger has done in California. He renegotiated, indicated during his election campaign that he was going to work with some of the tribes and renegotiate for placement of casinos in more populous areas and provide more gaming machines. They had theirs tied to a certain number within their compact. Expand what their numbers could be in order to do revenue sharing. And he has been successful in that in that approach. It's been interesting, though, from what I understand, and again, if I say something here that somebody has better information, I do hope they'll speak up, but it's my understanding from visiting with some Colorado colleagues that he actually did the negotiating himself, and it was the tribal chairs. He didn't, you know, they didn't delegate anyone else. And that, too, is something that sometimes I think we forget. While all of us may or may not like our governor, who is serving at the time in our respective states, they are the governor. And in looking to the governor, he or she, you have a he, we have a she, they can make some pretty awesome decisions, but they also have a legislature, you guys, to report to. And that's, in some ways, very similar to tribal governments. The notion that a lot of tribes have chiefs now, they have tribal chairs, and they too are elected by a constituency. But they can't unilaterally go out and make a decision either. They need to bring it back to their tribal chair. And so when we talk about government-to-government relationship, sometimes the cursory look is, well, it's the governor and the chair of the tribe or the chair of the nation. No, there's more people that are part of that government piece. And that has been a learning curve, not only for state legislatures, but also for tribal leaders. That's why that green book was written, to give a better understanding as to what the makeup is and how bills are handled. I do think, before I start the tape, I'm just going to hit a couple things in that green book because it may tie into what you see within the As much as I could make this, this is required reading when I served as chair of the committee. Not because I had helped to write it, but because I think that I found not only from the members of the legislature, but the members and the tribal chairs who participated in our meetings, it helped with attitude, approach, and a better knowledge base. As you look through there, it talks about some of the different kinds of cooperative agreements. It explains how tribal governments work. Having the tribal leaders as a part of our meetings, sitting at the table with us during our committee meetings was most helpful. What we found when a couple of issues were, you know, would be raised, the Attorney General's office kind of knew something about it and talked to the governor's office, and we were able to actually solve some things that didn't need legislation. Some things pertaining to adoption of children, some things pertaining to resource, natural resources. We had agreements that came forward in ways to have volunteer fire departments, and some of our tribes who have recently acquired very nice fire equipment be able to share those resources and share the expertise, so that people who had been fighting fires for a long time but didn't have the fancy equipment, and the people who had the fancy equipment who hadn't been fighting fires very long, all of a sudden, you know, they were able to work together. So it provided more of a forum than a great deal of litigation or a great deal of legislation. One significant piece that took about 3 or 4 years and a couple of information sessions to get past, it dealt with the deputization, cross-deputization. And part of that, I think, moved forward because there was an element of trust of people working together. There's information in the back here relative, I think the question was asked about the Kansas tribes, and if you would take a look at the back, it tells how different states approach their communication between tribal government and state government. There's a committee and commission. There is a Governor's Indian Interstate Council, GIIC, and that was established in 1949. It was through the National Governors Association. I don't know if they called themselves the National Governors Association back then, but it was all the governors. And they realized that while they did not have authority pertaining to tribal issues, that members of Indian nations also were members of their states, and how could they have a better understanding and kind of carry the message back and forth. And that's when they established GIIC. Joe Day, who I have worked with, is here today, and of course is your member here in Minnesota. Had an opportunity last year to attend their meeting in Traverse City, Michigan. And for every state that has a person, what we found is those are good liaisons. And while Joe may spend much of his time rather than with the legislature dealing with the federal level, I do appreciate his support and interest here today. And that can be a key tool. That was a key person for our committee in working through some issues. So you'll see some groups have gubernatorial appointments. All have a GIIC. Some will additionally have a joint committee. Others will have a tribal commission. Others will have a different way that they handle it. But all of it's captured in there for you. And while this book came out in 2000, it still is pretty current. I don't see a lot of differences, and I did review this the last couple of days. In addition, and again, I believe the gentleman over here had asked a question relative to negotiation, but it's the federally recognized tribes. In your state, I'm sure that you are aware of your tribes. You'll notice that some states have state-recognized tribes, too. And I remember when we were looking at first starting our committee in Kansas on the joint committee, a number of tribes came forward and wanted us to recognize them in state status. If you remember your American history, there used to be a point in time where there was the Mississippi River, and maps show that everything west of it was called Indian country. So Kansas, more so than your state, has had many different tribes that have kind of been assigned there and moved there and moved. And so we have, at any given time, four or five lawsuits pending, and we've had out-of-state tribes that want to build casinos over the cemetery where some of their ancestors, you know, we've had a lot of that kind of thing and have been able to work through that, but we have not done the state recognition route, and I don't believe you have either. Yours has been federal in approach. Another conversation that happened prior to me starting to address you, but in this room earlier, was in regard to the federal recognition process. And yes, there are a number of tribes that are seeking recognition. Some of those, I do believe, are for gaming purposes. Some are not. And the overall time for that, many times it can be 11 to 24 years before the recognition occurs. It's a long process. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, have any of you ever visited it or been there? Okay. It's an interesting place. And they've had a lot of turnover, and it is a very political place, more so than some of the other federal agencies that I've had an opportunity to work with. Right now, they have named a person to be the head of the BIA. They've had years of not having a chief of the BIA. And do any of you know Famous Dave Barbecue? Okay. The man who founded that.
Well.
Okay. Dave. I don't know Dave's last name.
Anderson.
Everybody else. Okay. Dave Anderson. He is the one who's been nominated to head the BIA, and that still is in flux.
No, he's already resigned.
Oh. Well, he's resigned now. Okay. So he's resigned. So we're again at an agency that has a significant amount of play right now in relative terms of the state, but not a lot of specific direction.
Okay, Senator, I'm going to ask you to hold up for a second. We have a question from Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Alene, first, thank you very much for coming here today. Anybody that will go north in February or March has my instant respect.
I figure with the name Alene, I'm married to a full Swede, and I feel like I've got some roots up here.
You're home.
You're welcome home. Couple issues that I'd appreciate your addressing, and kind of the Kansas perspective is why it's so valuable to have you here. The first is, are you taking into account in Kansas the impact that your putative compact, I know it hasn't been approved, but the pending compact would have on non-participating tribes? And then secondly is just kind of the whole spectrum of legality issues, particularly when you look off of current tribal lands. I mean, literally, can you rent out a deserted 7-Eleven and open a casino? Who's going to own the enterprise? Does it comply with federal law? Does it comply with ACRA? All of those various issues. That's where, as a state, we can probably do just about anything we want to in terms of adopting new laws to make it happen. My greater concern is the interplay with federal law and ACRA and all the various elements of federal law that, quite honestly, I don't know a great deal about, but I'm hoping that perhaps you do. So the first question is taking into account impact on non-participatory tribes, and the second one is the legality and the interplay with federal statutes.
Senator Rolene.
It's a good question, and I think it's multifaceted, so let me kind of break it into a few observations. One is that in looking at the number of tribes and the placement of tribes, what the Secretary of Interior, and she basically has run the show because, as I indicated, we don't have a BIA person. So you have her track record to look to, and she has been, in my opinion, pretty protective of the tribes, not to the exception of the states, but it would take a lot to be able to have a casino off of tribal land, because that trust responsibility that I mentioned earlier, they take into account, and the purpose of the BIA is to for economic development and protection of tribes. So knowing that, it would be a tough sell. Other tribal members who would not be in a new compact naturally are going to be worried about protection of market share. Now, you may have a state a lot different than Kansas, but I don't think so. When it comes to gaming, there are many players, and you've got quite a few to balance. It's not just tribal governments and state governments that want to be in the business of gambling. And whether it's the pari-mutuel industry, and at least in Kansas during in the pari-mutuel industry, we also have fights within the breeds. You know, you have like, maybe you haven't gotten that amount of detail yet, but there's all kinds of positioning that occurs. And so then it becomes state gaming, tribal gaming, and what about the rest of us gaming? And so you have those things that you have to measure as well. In Kansas, the proposed compact closes two casinos in Kansas. Two of the existing casinos would close, and they would together be a venture in the Kansas City market. Do the remaining two tribes like it? Not very much. But there has been communication between and among them, and one of the components was to, one of the tribes is very small, to look to a hospital facility in that part of the state. And those discussions are still occurring. The other tribe, in my opinion, has been approached and sold a bill of goods that will never happen in Wichita, Kansas. Wichita, Kansas is a veritable hot flashpoint of anti-gambling activity. So the city council would never approve it there. The Sedgwick County, you know, the county commissioners would never approve it. I doubt if the voters would, but if you don't have a city and these other people are adamantly opposed to it, they're not going to let people vote on that. So that piece doesn't liken it to the other tribes. So the governor, if she is successful in the legislature approving those, it wouldn't be the first time that they had been to Washington or talked to the Department of Interior. They've been there a lot since the inception. In Wyandotte County, in Kansas City, where this is, we have a new NASCAR track, the largest selling Cabela's. I mean, there's been a total turnaround in that part of the state on the Wyandotte County side. I think that the chances are very good for that particular one if it passes the legislature. These tribes would be forfeiting a location for a protected one. But the Kansas law, or the Kansas proposed compact, is different than any other one I've seen anywhere. And while it is totally the governor's prerogative to negotiate a compact, I will tell you that I've had some suggestions to put in that. And one of those was, let's finish gaming now. Let's have a total plan so that we don't have this every single session. Maybe not in Minnesota, but I mean, we get to where if you don't vote for the gaming proposal, I'm not going to vote for school finance. I mean, that kind of stuff has started permeating in my state. And some people are real tired of that. And some people, instead of just fight, they're saying, okay, let's see what the total picture would be. And you can't bind another legislature, but you can, through a compact, provide some disincentives that cause you to form a master plan. And that's what this compact is. It basically is a revenue sharing because it is a protected area, most populous part of Kansas by far, one casino, the ability for the legislature, if through majority vote, to put slot machines at three pari-mutuel tracks that we have, again, class three gaming. It tells exactly how many machines. It doesn't say what color the machines are, but it does say how many machines there will be. And if anything goes past that, all revenue from the compact is forfeited. That's how we would cure ourselves, I guess, of continuing gaming. Who likes it? Again, governor proposed it. By Kansas statute, it has to go to the State Tribal Relations Committee. And we wrestled with this all year. The session was out until November. And we made some counter proposals to the governor and the tribes in a public meeting. Some changes were made, and part of that was the amount of years before it would come up for renewal. The revenue sharing piece, you know, you've got two counties that were going to lose jobs because they're shutting down casinos. And revenue sharing occurred for them, kind of grow their economy out. So it's a multifaceted piece. The difficulty was it took a while to get done. And we got to a point the legislature had adjourned, and we have what we call the Legislative Coordinating Council. Do you have someone who operates when you're not in session?
No.
We're constitutionally limited to a 90-day session. So when we aren't in session, there are seven of us. Of course, there were seven of us. Well, there still are seven of them. But it was the president and the majority leader and the minority leader on the Senate side, and then four from the House side. Makes up a total of seven. They had the ability to approve the compact, but the hue and cry from the legislature was, this is too important a deal. We need to vote on this at the state, because we had either option in our state. And we deferred to the general membership that they would be able to, you know, vote on that this year. Does that answer some of your questions relative to, yes, you take into consideration, but when you've got all that local support, you've got a legislature that says yes, a governor who is visibly in touch the entire time, and two remaining tribes that aren't going to, well, they're not going to lose dollars, they're going to know what the total game plan in that state is too. That's what I think made the difference.
Any follow-up? Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's great to ask the question again.
Just a component of it.
Okay.
That with respect to Kansas, who's going to own and operate the proposed casino or casinos that's set forth under the compact?
Senator Rowling.
The shared, when we talk about sovereignty, of course, sovereignty isn't just state sovereignty and tribal. And we did the hybrid blend where it is, what they call it, the oversight, it's an oversight board of five. Two by the tribes, one each from the tribes, and three by the governor. And the governor would designate the chair of that. And that is a gaming oversight board. But the authority, final authority, rests with the state in the arrangement of the compact. That was a huge issue. That does not come easy. Remember, we were talking about how the governor can't do too much without us? Well, the tribal council had a vote, you know, of their membership, and it was very contentious, but that's where we got to, was that the state would be in charge.
Okay, let's move on to the video.
Okay.
Popcorn?
Mm-hmm. Put it in and put something here. Right here.
Will the page help you out here?
Don't make any noise.
Thank you. Under 10.
We've decided to rewind it. We'll be right
back. Okay. Well, members, while this is happening here, I just want to call your information, or call your attention, I guess, to some information in our packets. If you would look through your material there, you'll notice that there is a prepared statement here from House Counsel Elizabeth Long here, addressing to some degree the information and answers to Representative Lincheski's. I actually Representative Erickson's question to Representative Lincheski.
National Issues Forums provides opportunities for citizens to gather and deliberate.
Let's go. Proceed whenever you're ready.
Issues of the day. This forum focuses on gambling. With the help of a moderator and the framework for discussion contained in an issue book, gambling is presented in a nonpartisan way that encourages people to take a fresh look at the topic and at their convictions. Please remember that the choices outlined in this video are only three of the many choices you may discover in your discussions. Once it lurked in the shadows of America, down dark alleys, behind secret doorways, where criminals ruled and corrupt officials turned their heads. But no more! Shadows. Gambling has burst from the darkness into the mainstream of America. In convenience stores, malls, restaurants, gas stations, and even the internet. It is now legal in 48 states, and 37 of those states sponsor their own lotteries. 30 million Americans are weekly bettors, and 70 million bet occasionally. Far from being the illegal vice it once was, gambling is now a popular form of recreation and economic development. But although gambling has grown swiftly, our understanding of it has not. Hello, I'm Fran Dorn. While gambling increases at dizzying speeds, Americans lag behind, slow to develop clear views and policies about it. Is it a problem? And if so, what should we do? These are difficult questions,
And in this National Issues Forum, we're going to try to help answer them. Americans are ambivalent about gambling, and it's no wonder. The history of gambling in America is filled with contradictions. The early Puritans believed it was immoral, yet our very first settlement, Jamestown, was financed in part by an English lottery. Through the mid-1800s, gambling was considered a vice, and lotteries were outlawed in almost every state. That all changed in the 1860s, when lotteries were reinstated so we could finance our recovery from the Civil War. What followed was known as the Gilded Age of gambling, when riverboats plied the Mississippi, the slot machine was invented, and gambling halls flourished in the cities. Then at the turn of the century, reform movements led to the prohibition of gambling. Gambling went underground, ruled by the iron fist of the mafia. After a crackdown on organized crime, gambling was gradually reinstated legally, first for horse racing, then lotteries. Today, gambling is one of the fastest growing industries in America. Yet our feelings about it remain as confused as our heritage.
I'm winning!
Thoughts on gambling raise many questions. Questions that are more and more critical as gambling proposals pop up in nearly every state. Should gambling be legalized or banned? How can we reduce compulsive gambling? Does gambling attract crime? In the long run, does it help or hurt local economies? What does gambling say about our ethics and character as a nation? To help clarify these difficult questions, we're going to examine three choices concerning the direction our nation might take. Choice one, gambling doesn't create problems, it solves them. Cut the red tape on gambling. Choice two, gambling is dangerous and must be controlled. There should be regulations to make it safer. Choice three, gambling is socially and morally destructive. It should be phased out completely. Let's begin with choice one. Gambling doesn't create problems, it solves them. Chinook County, Mississippi. Once the poorest county in the poorest state in America. Over 80% of its residents relied on food stamps and public assistance. Many lived in shacks without indoor plumbing. That is, until 1990. That year, Tunica legalized gambling. 6 years later, it had 10 casinos, 6,000 hotel rooms, golf courses, a water park, and an outlet mall. It also had jobs. So many jobs, the residents couldn't fill them. Gambling has also benefited our nation's most disadvantaged citizens, Native Americans. Native American casinos have become a multi-billion dollar a year industry, providing more than 280,000 jobs. Advocates of Choice One say such communities and many public programs have been economically reborn through gambling. And gambling, they say, is no longer the corrupt, damaging force it used to be. It is an entertainment industry, simply another way to have fun. In fact, Choice One advocates don't even like the term gambling. They prefer gaming. Gaming, they say, is a normal and safe form of play, as ancient as humankind itself. Now it's a major American pastime, drawing larger crowds than Major League Baseball games, and earning more dollars than Americans spend on books, music, and movies combined. The industry is already well controlled, they say. It poses no special social risks and needs no special restrictions. Statistics that link gaming to crime are misleading. The truth is that crime increases wherever you have crowds. As for the problem of compulsive gambling, advocates of Choice One say this is a psychological disorder that exists even before its victims enter the gaming hall. Not only that, but the gaming industry has taken the lead in funding programs to prevent and treat compulsive gambling. Choice One advocates believe gambling is being blamed for pre-existing social ills, when in fact, its revenues provide the solution to many of these problems.
Gambling is not a magic economic silver bullet that is going to solve the economic problems of every community. Gambling can, however, if it's made part of a carefully crafted economic development plan for a community. provide a tremendous economic lift to a community.
Critics of Choice One say that gaming is a predatory industry that preys on human weakness, leading to addiction, bankruptcy, and crime. For every $1 a state receives in gambling revenue, it faces $3 worth of gambling-related social ills. They claim that it's the ease and accessibility of gambling that leads to compulsive gamblers. As for crime, there's only one bottom line. Many communities with casinos have higher crime rates. Opponents to Choice One argue that gambling may create new jobs, but meanwhile it steals business from other retail and recreational outlets. For the good of American society, they say, gambling must be restricted, just as we restrict firecrackers, speed limits, and other individual freedoms.
Gambling is so different from other addictive forms of activities in the United States. State governments and federal government spends literally billions of dollars every year to try to keep people from drinking too much or smoking too much or doing drugs at all. These are the big addictions in our country, and our states and federal governments work really hard to prevent the abuse of those addictive drugs. But, you know, the other really serious addiction in the United States is gambling. And instead of spending money to prevent the abuse of gambling, states actually spent money to encourage people to gamble.
Now let's examine our second choice. Gambling is dangerous and must be controlled.
I get shots until I drop.
I'd buy out my company and have my boss work for me.
This is the way New York State once advertised its lottery.
This Wednesday, someone could win millions of dollars.
I'd buy a baseball team for Brooklyn.
New York Lotto. All you need is a dollar and a dream.
This is the way it advertises it now.
Nobody should look at it as a way to get rich.
You're on the high, but you do it for the fun.
Hooray!
Never know.
The old ad, with its elusive promise of sudden riches, was scrapped by Governor George Pataki for one that was more realistic, oriented more towards public service than personal gain. Advocates of Choice 2 are especially concerned about state lotteries. Today, states spend over $370 million trying to coax people to bet. States which promote their lotteries can no longer serve as reliable watchdogs. In some cases, the very commission that promotes casinos is also responsible for regulating them. A clear conflict of interest.
The state is supposed to protect its citizens, but here they are taking advantage of the weakest citizens in their state.
It could happen at any time. A chance meeting with fate.
All right, lottery tickets.
Those who support Choice 2 believe revenues from gambling should not fund state programs. Instead, they should be used to pay for the cost of gambling-related problems, such as treatment programs. A recent study reports that one in every 100 adult Americans and four in every 100 adolescents are addicted to gambling. Choice 2 advocates say that casinos need regulation because they encourage irresponsible gambling. They offer incentives such as free meals, alcohol, and ATM machines so that people will bet excessively. Gambling opponents link casinos with an increase in such crimes as rape, robbery, aggravated assault, and larceny. Critics worry too about corruption. Over the past 5 years, gambling interests have poured millions of dollars into political contributions, lobbying efforts, and election campaigns. Choice 2 demands programs and restrictions to prevent and control addiction, crime, and corruption. And these controls should come from the citizens, who right now have a limited voice in decisions about casinos and gambling. Too often, legislators make their choices without consulting voters. Opponents of Choice 2 say these views are based on old, outmoded stereotypes of gambling. That the gaming industry is already highly regulated, and most Americans gamble without any problem. ATMs do not promote excessive gambling, they say. Depression and psychological problems do. Furthermore, They feel any restrictions would harm the communities that can most benefit from the financial gains, such as Native Americans. Still others believe that even regulations cannot make gambling safe and productive. It is a predatory industry based on false hopes and the exploitation of human frailties. The third choice on gambling is phase out gambling completely. The gambler, according to Navajo history, was a child of the spirit of the sun who learned to gamble from his father. After he won and then lost everything in the world, he became known as the one who wins people, an evil adversary to be feared and resisted. Only two states in America, Utah and Hawaii, and one Native American nation, the Navajos, have banned all forms of gambling. The Navajos, saying they would not be blinded by filthy lucre, voted against casinos, even though their unemployment rate is near 50%, and casinos could earn them $60 million a year.
These are the kind of moral decisions advocates of Choice 3 would like to see. They believe gambling is as wrong as prostitution. Both leave behind a trail of victims, sickness, ruined lives, crime, and corruption. Gambling, they say, can never be harmless, even with regulations. And even though it can never be stopped, it should not be condoned and legalized, thus becoming a social norm.
To these people, gambling undermines the very values that make America so special. A good life, earned by honest work and perseverance. Gambling is also a fraud. It plays on people's illusions and greed. In truth, statisticians claim the chances of winning a state lottery are less than being hit by lightning. So close to zero, they are almost negligible. The claim of good works from state lotteries is also misleading. In Georgia, most lottery tickets are bought by low-income people, but the profits finance college scholarships for the middle class.
Choice 3 advocates want an immediate halt on the industry's growth. No new gambling ventures and no expansion of existing ones. States should lose their lotteries. Advertisements for gambling should be banned. Nonprofit organizations should find alternative sources of revenue. Community organizations must launch programs that expose the dangers of gambling, particularly school programs. And the media should stop glamorizing the one in a million lottery winner.
The economic arguments have recently been turned to by those who are morally opposed to gambling. I have no argument, and our industry has no argument with these people. Now, this is a country that was founded by people with strong moral and religious views. However, they have no right to push their views on the majority of people, and it's clearly a majority in this country, who view gambling, whether or not it's going to a casino, whether or not it's buying a lottery ticket, whether or not it's spending an afternoon at the track, as an enjoyable means of entertainment, whereby they make a decision with their own hard-earned money as to how they're going to enjoy themselves.
Opponents of Choice 3 protest government control over how people spend their free time and money. Why ban any activity just because it's bad for some people? Should we also ban fast cars and red meat? Gambling is human nature, and we gamble every day. In real estate, the stock market, and business. Outlawing gambling would only turn millions of Americans into outlaws and encourage criminal activity. With its enormous revenues for social programs, gaming is a solution, not a problem.
These, then, are the three choices that emerge from the national confusion over gambling.
Choice 1, cut the red tape on gambling. Choice 2, increase regulations to make gambling safer. Choice 3, phase out gambling completely. Over the years, America has gone through many gambling cycles. First legalizing it, then discovering its problems, banning it, then legalizing it again. Today's cycle is familiar, and yet it is different. For the first time, gambling is a mainstream pastime supported by mass advertising and promotion. And as it expands, so do our concerns.
With careful consideration and discussion of the choices, perhaps America can enter a new cycle, one that assures the future of gambling, whatever it is based on informed choices. Gambling is a game of chance. But it is intelligent, informed decisions, and not chance, that will determine its future. A future in which, hopefully, we can all be winners. Thank you for participating in this National Issues Forum.
Chairman, I am the new chairman.
Damn. And things are going to be different. We all know who the real chair is anyway.
I was just going to say that while this does not deal strictly with tribal gaming and tribal governments gaming, it does help me anyway to better delineate that we all come from different perspectives on the gaming issue, and there is accompanying material to this video if people want to see that. I will leave that too with Brian relative to the kind of framing the issue at hand. Proceeding for just a moment.
Senator, if I can interrupt you for a moment, I believe we've got a question by Representative Zeller.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask a question, but maybe we should just proceed to the vote right now with you and the chair.
Your call.
Thank you. And Senator Lean, it's my pleasure to see you again. You spoke at the Build Conference this fall that I think Representative Lesh is still over there at. And if there's anyone that can work in a bipartisan manner, I'm quite positive you can help us with this. My question is on the third parties. We've got a small retail location down here in Bloomington that draws a couple million people a year right next to the airport called the Mall of America.
In there. That's
you and most of America and part of Canada. And in that we see an outside source that would be very interested in putting a casino in their location. We've also had interest from some of the Las Vegas folks to come in here and put a casino in. How have you folks in Kansas dealt with those outside or third-party sources? Because now we're not talking just the state and the tribes. We're talking about the real professionals in Las Vegas coming into our space.
And it's tough policy decisions. You know, when we were talking earlier about compacts, and I'd mentioned that in my terminology, there's a tribe that has a contract, and that was actually two. And both of those are in the state of Connecticut. The Massapequot tribe, as well as Mashantucket Pequot tribe, as well as the Mohegan. And when Connecticut, and again, those little states, you know, back east, I mean, they just are on top of each other and crawling with people. So they had a lot of competition within and among the states there. And Mr. Trump was very interested in Connecticut. And the Connecticut legislature was too excited about going with the big guys on this. And that's when they struck upon the notion, let's have a contract with the tribe. At that point, it was just the Pequots, the Mohegan. I don't believe either had federal recognition, or they didn't have their act together in some way. But they received significant dollars and do not have the influence of the big business side. How did it happen? Policy decision, state legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative.
You're doing a fine job.
Thank you very much. Get used to this. Are there any other questions? Senator Olin.
Okay. Going ahead with other models and methods. So I'm on Roman numeral 6 here. We've mentioned the Pequot tribe just now, California with Governor Schwarzenegger, and again, that was a very visible kind of making it happen. Executive branch said he was going to do it, talked about it during the election, went in, and again, won on, I believe there are 13 new compacts that he negotiated, and most of them are very similar in what their methodology is. A third kind of model out there that I wasn't aware of until about 2 years ago, and was speaking in Arizona and had been asked to go see a new tribal casino there. And what they've done They too, like most states, have some tribes that live in very populated areas or the reservations are close to population centers, and other tribes that are not. And the tribes work together there, and the tribes that are in the more rural locations, they have a certain number of machines in the population areas, and that's how they get their revenue. And again, that it's not just the tribes talking with one another, but that was done in concert and in conjunction with the state legislature and the executive branch in Arizona. It may be happening other places. I've heard that they have discussed it in Washington State, but I know that it's in operation in Arizona because I saw it. I've spoken about the Kansas Compact. I thought I might just take a little more time there. And again, it is one that is proposed. I will tell you that if I had had the opportunity, I would have voted for it, and it was primarily because it made the plan from there forward. That's what I liked about it. You can't tell the legislature 3 years, 5 years down the road what they can or cannot do. But if you have a compact with a pretty big stick, chances are that it's going to keep. That did not, however, in any way close the door on additional tribal gaming in the state. But remember when I was talking earlier that if the governor doesn't want to negotiate on land that is not in trust prior to October 17, 1988, he or she doesn't have to. That certainly was going to be the case in the way that we had our hearing structured and to work that. An interesting group that ended up supporting that bill in the 11th hour, and again, this is when the session's not on and the LCC was operating, but it was known statewide, was were those people who were involved in the paramutual industry. They all came on board because they saw that as their possibility to get something passed. So what's happened since then? Kansas legislature's meeting. This proposal is off its side for now, and all of the gaming forces that come back every year starting in January and they're until the session's over, they're all trying different proposals, and all those will fail. And then this one will come out, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator O'Lean, dig into the Kansas Compact a little bit deeper. What initiated it? Was it started about 10 years ago? Did I pick that up right? And what's kind of the quid pro quo? Is it just the reservations close down a casino, but then they get to go to a populated area and get its exclusive coverage of that, and then What is in the compacts for the state? What percentage was in the old compacts, and then now what percentage of?
Well, remember we were talking about first generation compacts. Those were the ones that didn't have renewal and did not have revenue sharing, and it was clearly understood by the majority of states that there was no way that you could share revenue through egress. And it wasn't attempted, with the exception of this contract on the side I was talking about relative to Connecticut. What prompted it? Probably the same basic reason you're looking at doing something, or the state legislature, or I may be over-assuming, but you might have a little bit of a budget problem. And people are very reticent for a variety of reasons, legislators, usually reticent to raise taxes. So it was seen more as, well, we can expand an existing activity in our state and be able to capture dollars. But are we going to have tribal governments do it? Or are we going to, because as state governments, we're already doing it. So are we going to kind of look at the track record of tribal governments and how they have run their gambling avenues and expand those and keep our hands out of it? Or are we as state governments going to sanction the private sector to do it? And that's been the push-me-pull-me, I think, of the policy issue. Percentage-wise, I don't have that right in front of me. I've got the entire proposal here. But even if I gave you a percentage, it's all relative as to what you're looking at for infrastructure, if it's a 10-year, if you're going to have union wages, I mean, all those things figured into it. And I will leave this here. And maybe I would even have an answer if there's a little downtime. I could look through this compact again. I guess it reflects my sentiment that that part wasn't as important to me as knowing that there was a plan that could work in the future. I am concerned that nearly $1 million was donated in or contributed in various campaign efforts in Kansas the last two election cycles by the gaming industry. And as a floor leader, seeing the amount of horse trading potential that gambling exhibited was a concern about the institution for me. So those were things that I personally found very appealing to us. Some people raise fairness issues. Why would you let Indians have gambling and non-Indians not? And again, it's your frame of reference and where people come from. I saw it as state governments have gaming and tribal governments have gaming. And we've already had our times when the private sector had it years ago and it wasn't quite as transparent as what we have now.
Does that answer your question, Representative Westrom?
Yeah.
Well, Senator, as far as along that line, though, questioning here and the fairness issue here, one of the things I guess my concern would be our governor seems to be pretty adamant about the fact that it really is a fairness issue and the fact that this is an industry that's, you know, developing a lot of money. In Kansas, with what you did, was the money that is revenue sharing from gaming compacts, is that money used for dedicated for budgeting purposes?
It was going to be, I think, in the neighborhood, again, we're not as large a state as you are, but I think it was a neighborhood of $50 or $60 million that would come in from that. And it was to go to the state general fund. Now, that is unlike some of the proposals in the past, you know, that have come forward through private sector and we're going to put all the money into schools, and then people get in the policy issue, do we want to use gambling revenue to pay for kids' school? And so this just went state general fund. Already we know that in tribal gaming, the money has to go for government relations, government responsibilities and improvement of tribes, and they have a tracking system on that. We also wanted to be sure that we carved out a part for problem gaming. And that was one through the State Tribal Relations Committee that I told you that I chaired. We saw that we negotiated a percentage up from that. Not suggested. We didn't negotiate. We suggested in the compact that they consider that again, and we did get that up a little bit. All of the costs and of enforcement, and background checks, and all of that, of course, was a part prior to the percentage that went to the state.
Any other questions? Okay, Senator Orlean, does that complete your presentation? Or
just about. Okay. I just got two more things I wanted to point out. I will leave the Kansas Compact for you to take a look at. I have started around, I don't know where it is right now, but there's a little booklet that talks about the last meeting of the National Council of Legislators from Gaming States. You saw Frank Ferencamp, who is the president of the International Gaming Association. He was there in Florida speaking to us, as was the Attorney General for the National Association of American Unions. If any of you have the opportunity to go to that, I'm no longer involved, so I'm not getting any kind of any action here, nor was I when I was a member of it, but I have found that to be so helpful in learning about gaming issues. They are complicated. The industry knows them a heck of a lot better than we do. And I would encourage you to see that balance. There are people who want to there are ones, twos, and threes, according to the that tape that you just saw, that participate in the Nickel Juice meetings, and it would be wise for you. I know at one time you did have people attending, and we joined, but the I think the dues are like $4,000 a year or something. It's not a huge issue. But we always made certain that we had a Republican and a Democrat from each chamber go to every meeting. And I think that helped to raise the level of knowledge, not only when we dealt with the issue in our committee, but when we dealt with the lobbyists who came to see us about those issues in the committee. The last piece that, it isn't that I purposely left big spots there for current activity options, discussion, strategy, but just a couple of suggestions. One of those, as you move forward and looking to something, make certain that there is a local government acceptance. They can cause you havoc. If you're going to try to go to the feds and you don't have the city commission on board or you don't have the county, we really need to have, you know, our local government partners involved in that. In communicating with the governor, again, when I heard what your plan, your statute is regarding the ability for the governor to have an R&D from each chamber, I think that's good. I think it does take a bipartisan look to it. But also be aware that whoever your governor is, if they say no to off-site, it's not going to happen in Washington. I am absolutely positive. And the star lineup right now with, politically speaking, you have a Republican president and a Republican governor, and if they hear from the Republican governor of Minnesota that he doesn't want something that they have federal control on that side, it just won't happen. So working cooperatively with your governor, I think, is important. The look to other resident tribes, and again, it wouldn't matter if it was this particular business activity or others. When others feel that they are going to lose part of the share of the pie, you're going to have to make some policy decisions as to what you think is best relative to the rest. And I wish you luck on that. And having a complete picture is awfully tempting, I would think, to you. And knowing what the game plan for gaming is for your state, you have the opportunity to look at that through a compacting process. You just have to decide if you're willing to paint it. So, with that, I see if there are any final questions. I've spent my time here.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Alene, just back to the compacts. Did I understand the ones, there's some that are still waiting to be passed by the Kansas legislature. What's the holdup? When did they get finished, and what's holding them up right now? Why didn't they get passed last year or the year before?
And, Senator, before you answer that question, I just want to make an announcement as far as we probably will extend our time here because we'd like to allow the Native American community, too, to come to the microphone here and ask questions, too, if they would like, or of Senator Rowling. So, with that, could you?
There was, we had four compacts, four reservations, all of that done more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time we've had a compact that has been presented to the legislature, but see, we're a part-time legislature, so it went directly to the State Tribal Relations Committee, and we worked the issue. We made some suggestions in the compact once it was presented to us. The Legislative Coordinating Council, that group of seven, had the ability to vote on that and send it on with the governor to the BIA. Some members of the Coordinating Council felt they did not want to vote on that. They wanted the entire legislature to vote on it. So there were not four votes to send it full. We never brought it to a vote because it doesn't take much to count seven noses. Mm-hmm. So it now is with the legislature.
So, Mr. Chair, follow-up,
representative.
So you only meet every other year?
No, they're meeting right now.
Well, they are.
But because it wasn't approved, all of the forces are back, so to speak, all the gaming forces, and they have all these other ideas this year. And those are being played out now. And there's money, all the money's going to go to education in one of them. And another one, we're going to have 7 casinos around Kansas. We only got 2 million people, but we're going to, you know, have them, and we're going to have county option. There's all these different plans that are out there, just like there have been the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are going to get their play. Some people are betting on the fact that because money's tight, that one of those might pass. But if it does, the big compact with the $250 million destination casino by these two tribes will go away. But there's just not enough people to support a number of them. So it's in abeyance right now. The governor makes a decision. She will decide when that is ready to go, and she's worked with the leadership, and everybody is mutually agreeable that it will run after these others have had their play.
Okay.
And that's when I added my little caveat that I don't think any of those will pass any more this year than they have in the past.
Okay, Mr. Any further questions? Mr. Day, could we ask you to come down to see if you have any questions or comments? Or is there any member of the audience who would like to come up here and... Mr. Buffalo, welcome to our committee.
Hi, how are you?
Please state your name for the tape and tell us who you represent, and we're looking forward to your questions or comments.
Thank you, Chairman Westerberg and the members of the community, our committee. My name is Henry Buffalo, and I represent the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which is located north in the area near Duluth. And Senator, thank you for coming down and sharing your experience with the committee and with the members of the audience. One of the questions that I had for you is although we don't know yet the sort of final plan of the governor, we have pieces of information about it, and one of the pieces that seems to exist is that the plan will not include the activity off-reservation activity being done under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Now, I read in the Kansas Compact that you are doing it under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And my question about that is that it seems that within the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, there's a sort of a model for due diligence review that's inherent within the agreement or within the federal law. And that due diligence review will be done by the Secretary of Interior as a part of the compact as proposed. Is it your sense that that was an important part between the state people and the tribal people, that was an important part to have?
Senator Rowling.
In talking about a particular component to it, it was. And the reason is because we did want to follow EGRA. If you stray too much from that and you turn this work product that involves a lot of hours and facets to it over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Secretary of Interior, and it's not in line with EGRA, you may have done a lot of work to jeopardize that yes or no, and you're hoping to get the approval. And that's what's been kind of hard for me as a legislator and other legislators to realize that, I mean, we can pass them, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. When it comes to tribal issues, I mean, there's somebody else that's going to decide if what we pass becomes law or not. And so you in following what those guidelines are, and knowing that with IGRA, you know, the money that is kept by the tribes has to be spent in certain ways, and the legislature and looking at theirs, and that's why we did that oversight board made up of both the state and the two tribes, and saying 24-hour calls, these people are on. And it's kind of like a joint venture, but it was under IGRA.
Mr. Buffalo?
Chairman Westford, one additional question. was it also important in terms of that role that the Secretary of Interior has under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, that in a sense there would be a kind of independent review of the proposed compact that would take into consideration both the benefits that would derive to both the state and the tribes who participated, but also with respect to the non-participating tribes?
Senator Olin.
I don't remember that component directly mentioned in our compact. I do remember that of four tribes, I mean, two are in the compact and two aren't. And there was some concern by the two that aren't in it, that once this other compact existed, or if it got approved and had revenue sharing, was the state going to be able to come back and make them revenue share and so on? And the answer is absolutely no, because the compact has, both sides have to agree to open one. And the opening of the compact for the Sac and Fox and the Kickapoo, the two tribes that were looking to do the Kansas City venture with the state, they were in agreement. The other two were not, so they were not impacted.
Chairman Westberg, just one more.
Mr. Buffalo.
Please. In follow-up to that, Senator, would you think, or would you say that it would be a good thing if that's a part of the Secretary's review? Would it be a good thing for them to do this independent inquiry to determine what the impacts would be to the non-participating tribes?
Senator Olin.
Thank you. I don't think there's anything that would preclude that from occurring. And what we found, or what I noted myself, I really did encourage the two tribes to visit with the two who were not a part of the new compact. But I think what really in many ways helped take the edge off was the fact that tribal gaming ventures each year, they get worried too as to what's going to happen to their area and to their market. And knowing what the whole game plan would be, I can't say it appeased everyone, but it made it a more settled approach.
Mr. Westerberg.
Mr. Buffalo.
I mean, Chairman Westerberg, if I may indulge the committee just. You mentioned in your presentation that when the two, according to the compact, two of the facilities that the tribe operates will close, and that will have an impact on the counties where those were being operated, and that there was some provision within the compact to sort of make whole those counties in light of those impacts. Was there a similar provision for the non-participating tribes, should they be adversely impacted by the opening of this new facility, that they would be made whole?
Senator Olin?
That was not done. However, we did have, and I'm thinking specifically of one of the tribes, indicated that they felt they would have as much as a 24% loss within their area should Wichita, which is their market. This particular proposal, instead of a full casino in Wichita, it limited it to 500 slot machines at the existing track. So once they saw what the two differences could be, they seemed to not be as concerned as originally then. But as far as additional money to go to them, no.
Okay. Mr. Buffalo.
Neither did the revenue sharing component affect them.
Mr. Buffalo, I have a quick question for you. As far as the casino in Duluth, is that, it's downtown Duluth, isn't it? I've never been there, but is that on reservation land?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. You might want to stick around just for a couple other questions, but Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question came up. I think Mr. Buffalo might be the one to answer it, but Senator O'Lean might have a perspective on it. Now, in Minnesota, some of the discussion of having a casino and partnering with reservations, are you saying the federal government has a final say over that? And as I understand our law, we could as a state authorize a casino without the federal government. So I'm curious, why does the federal government have to come in and decide whether we or whether they approve or not a casino that would be on state or private land that would be partnered with the tribes? Whoever's got an answer to that, I'm just perplexed.
Right. I do have an answer. I'm reaching for it. I would tell you that the Marshall Trilogy that I mentioned earlier, and federal law, and the trust status, the states do not have authority. It is the federal government in regard to tribes. So even when we have compacts, and you have, how many do you have in place right now?
Two.
The two existing compacts that you have had to be approved by the Secretary of Interior after you passed them. If you do something that is off of the EGRA tenets, which is October 17th of 1988, if you try to negotiate and have something after that, and you work with the tribes, and you everyone agrees that passes the legislature, it still has to go to the federal government because they are the ones that have the sole responsibility for protection of the tribes.
And Senator, I said corrected, there's 22. There's two for each of the 11 tribes.
Okay. 11 years. So those 22, and all of those are about the same age as ours, aren't they? Aren't they about 10 years?
No, 89.
I think we're all first generation. And this third generation that I'm talking about, those are the ones that would deal with any kind of revenue sharing. And those are really scrutinized.
Any other questions, Representative Wilson?
Mr. Chair, so Senator O'Lean, basically if we as a state, we can choose as a state to just open up the casino or license it to a private company, and then we wouldn't need the federal approval. But when we negotiate in a contract or a compact with the tribes, then there's the federal oversight that comes into play just because we're negotiating with them.
Senator Rowling.
Well, there's not a quick yes or no on that. Let me just say that when you are dealing with opening a casino in your state, you really have to take a close look at what your constitution affords you. If your constitution says that you can have a casino or that your lottery can operate it and so on, then you move forward. And we've had those bills in Kansas to have the lottery run the casino and be the first state in the United States where state government is promoting a casino and owning it. We decided we didn't want to be that. We didn't want to, you know, many of them will have like a slot machine, but the actual table games, the cash games, the kinds of things that need significant oversight, it's very expensive for a state to assume that responsibility and to build the facility.
Okay, any further questions? Please come down. Someone else from the audience here would like to ask a question. Thank you, Mr. Buffalo, for sharing those questions with us and information. Sir, please state your name for the tape and tell us who you represent.
Hi. My name is William Means. I represent the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors.
Welcome. Welcome and, to the committee, Mr. Means.
Thank you. My question, before I make it, I wanted to straighten out some misleading information. that's coming out, especially in the governor's proposal. That is to say that with the three tribes that are in the governor's proposal, it's been promoted that they represent a majority of reservation Indians, or a majority of Indians in northern Minnesota. I want to be clear here that over 60% of the Indian people in Minnesota live in urban areas. So in fact, those three reservations actually represent a minority of Indians in Minnesota. So my question to Senator Olin is, did you make any provisions in your bill or in your history in working with the tribes for those Indian people living in urban areas?
Senator Olin.
The interaction and distribution of revenues from tribal gaming in our compacts, that's decided by the tribal governments, not state governments. So we really didn't have any provisions, nor should we have had any. But that's tribal government business.
Okay. Any other questions?
I guess one other point, just to say that when us as Indian people, when we leave the reservation, you receive very little or no benefits from your home community. So I wanted to make that clear also as well as part of that.
Thank you, Mr. Means.
And I
Senator?
I agree on that particular component that there's some misinformation. It's kind of like if you are retired military too, and whether or not you live by military installation. You know, it's likened to that kind of support. And what I have noticed in my state, a number of people who do not live at the reservation, some of them have returned because there are job opportunities there, but also through the campaign process, they have gained the ear of people who are running for tribal spots to say, hey, let's take a look at the rest of us here as well. So there's been a lot of encouragement in representation in tribal governments in the last few years as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you again, Mr. Means. Mr. D, welcome to our committee, and please state your name and tell us who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Joe D with the Indian Affairs Council. This is not directly with gaming, however, it's a promotion for state-tribal relations. As Senator Olin said, that the Governor's Interstate Indian Council has been going on since 1949, and it actually started here in Minnesota by Governor Ruth Yandall, the one that banned gambling back then. That was a campaign. However, it preceded its action by some research that was begun in 1937 by Governor Ed Tye by trying to encourage state-tribal relations. And my concern with the topic today, it kind of destroys state-tribal relations, you know, one issue. And Minnesota, I've been with Indian Affairs for 10 years, and Minnesota is up here with state-tribal relations, and the rest of the states are over here. You know, and part of this activities, you know, corrects that. I think Minnesota has done a wonderful job meeting some of the needs of Indians prior to, you know, this entertainment business. You know, every time I go to the meetings and talk about what we're doing in Minnesota with the states and how each of the departments, whether it's natural resources, human services, health, we've got an excellent working relationship. So these kinds of activities really stifle good tribal-state relations. So I just want to support that. And it may be an unintended consequence that this is being deteriorated by, you know, the topic here today.
Oh, Mr. Day, I certainly think so. I think, you know, we certainly recognize, you know, Minnesota being a leader back in 1963, you know, establishing, like you said, the first Indian Council here in our state. And, you know, my intent, and I think the committee's and our governor's intent, is to certainly strengthen Indian relations, and that's what we're trying to do here. You know, we want to make sure that doors are open for communication, and we want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity, you know, to be part of the discussions that are occurring. And so it's my hope that you know, you would understand at least that that's what I'm trying to accomplish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think good working and meeting Senator Olin in the past few years. I think you will have recognized that today as to why they've accomplished things. It all is based on attitude, respect, sincerity. Without that, you're going nowhere. Thank you.
Absolutely, and well said. Thank you, Mr. Dade. Anyone else? Okay, not seeing any further questions. Senator Olin, thank you so much for making the trip all the way up here in March, like Representative Atkins pointed out. We really appreciate it. I should mention that the Senator is going to be around here for the night, and so if there are any last-minute questions that come up tomorrow morning, we might have an opportunity to ask those. So if anything comes up and you have a question later, please feel free to contact me or our staff here. We'd all be happy to contact the Senator, and thank you again for coming, making the trip.
Thank you very much.
With that, members, we're kind of holding for the governor's bill here. We think we're going to have it real soon in our possession. It's still being ironed out a little bit. And as soon as we get it, we're going to have to be a little fluid as far as discussing when our next meeting will be, but it should be coming up. We'll let you know next week as soon as we have the information. With that, we're adjourned.